This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
There's other painters that are making voyeuristic paintings that are winking at the voyeur. There's other painters that are using their own family. But only Vermeer brought it to such a provocative point.
That's art historian Ben Binstock talking about his book, Vermeer's Family Secrets.
It's a book about secrets and lies, really. It's a book about the little lies we tell to varnish over secrets.
And that's Hallie Efron. She tells us about her new mystery, Never Tell a Lie. But first, we delve into the family mysteries of one of my favorite painters, Jan Vermeer. One of the greatest artists of the Dutch Golden Age, Vermeer worked and lived in relative obscurity in the small town of Delft. The common view is that only some 35 or 37 paintings survive of Vermeer's. But my guest Benjamin Binstock says the number is actually some 8 paintings less than that. That's because, he says, those 8 were painted by a secret apprentice, a member of Vermeer's family. This is just one of the mysteries Binstock reveals in his book, Vermeer's Family Secrets. The painter's work, he says, provides a window into the home life of a very dysfunctional family. Domestic violence, financial struggles, the difficult dynamics of debt and obligation all play out in the pages of his book. They're hidden among and behind the gorgeous colors and meticulously detailed interiors we see in Vermeer's paintings and in those of his apprentice. Benjamin Binstock, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
You start your book, Vermeer's Family Secrets, Genius Discovery and the Unknown Apprentice. You start it with 2 of my very favorite paintings by Vermeer, and Vermeer is one of my favorite painters, and that is Het Straatje and then The View from Delft. You have some interesting discussion about Het Straatje, which means a little street. Describe this painting for us and tell us why you think it depicts who it does.
The name Het Straatje, actually, it's not clear that it means necessarily the little street, because another meaning of Het Straatje, Tje is a diminutive, and Straat means street, but they could also mean the little alleyway. And the funny thing is that this picture is almost seems like the alley at the center of the picture could be the main subject. There is a house, but the house is cropped at the right. And then there's another house, smaller house, that's only a sliver of it is shown at the left. And in between that is an alley and another doorway that, if you look into it carefully, it shows a passage to more houses behind. It's a very strange thing that it doesn't seem to be showing really anything. There's a woman sitting in the threshold of the house at the right. She seems to be sewing or maybe embroidering. She could be fixing clothing, repairing. There's 2 little children playing on the stoop. You can't see their faces, and you can't really tell exactly what they're doing. And there's a lady in the alley there's a broom next to her, and she's standing at a barrel, which is presumably a barrel of water. So she must be doing something like cleaning, and it seems like she's probably a servant woman. So the funny thing about this picture is, as you say, it's very beautiful, and it's very engaging. And I think part of that is precisely because it doesn't present its subject in an aggressive way. There's a way that it's, you could say, the artist is letting things be. These people are doing what they're doing without being demonstrative about it or performing something. The houses are kind of as they are in their anonymity and the obscurity of the view. And I think that has to do with the essence of part of what makes Vermeer such a great artist is what I would call a poetic naturalism, a naturalism which is manipulated, but that's very profoundly informed by observation of reality.
And who he's presenting is also very interesting. I've studied many of his paintings, and there are only, 23 of them that are known. So there are not that many to study, but there's The Milkmaid, which is another favorite of mine. And
yes.
And you point out that the servant in the alley in the painting Hetstratia is wearing the same clothes as the milkmaid. And,
yes.
And you think you know who she is.
Yes. I actually call what I'm doing partly a hermeneutics of the obvious. I don't neglect the obvious, which is that Vermeer is simply portraying the world around him. It really would seem the most obvious thing would be for him to portray his own house, his own children playing on the stoop in front of his house, and his wife in the threshold, and the servant in the alley. The funny thing is, nobody suggested that, but the funny thing is, the earliest identification of where the scene is was Vermeer's house. And because that was back in 1920 or so, and the man who made that identification got the location of the house wrong, and in a kind of typical way of scholarship, everybody just ignored that possibility because he seemed to be wrong, whereas all it was needed was a slight adjustment. He didn't realize that the alley was an alley. He took it for a street, which really wasn't possible, and he got the house on the wrong side of the street. But all you have to do is cross over to the other side of the street. That's where Vermeer's house was, and it all makes perfect sense. So there's both a return to the obvious and a return in some ways to some of the earliest proposals in Vermeer scholarship. And the two things go together because people usually propose the obvious and then they get more complicated and then we lose our way. And this relates to a larger argument, which is that in the 19th century, the Dutch genre painters, which is paintings of everyday life, genre is a French word for categories, all these different categories, still life, landscape, domestic scene, or urban landscape, in this case, is what you'd call scene of houses inside the town. In the 19th century, they said these things were based on the artist's observation, and that has been rejected by more recent scholars as naive and anachronistic. Again, this is I think it's a thesis worth returning to, which is that, yes, indeed, that's what makes genre paintings so compelling, is they were, in a very objective way, observing their surroundings.
And his surroundings were very family-based. Your book, Vermeer's Family Secrets. Why the secrets?
Well, on a certain level, what we just talked about, if it's not recognized, it's secrets. The very use of his family is something that's still not recognized in the scholarship. But on a more important level, there were all kinds of strange things going on in Vermeer's family that we know about that I think are reflected in his paintings.
Family secrets right around him. Now, you talk about the fact that he lived in his mother-in-law's house. She was a Catholic, and he had not been raised as a Catholic. Talk about Vermeer's family, not his family of origin, but the family he married into, and particularly his mother-in-law.
Well, he was raised as a Protestant. Catholicism was officially illegal in the Dutch Republic, which is Protestant, but it was tolerated, usually because they paid money to local authorities and because there were a great number of Catholics in Holland from before it became a Protestant Republic, so they had to be tolerated. And Vermeer's wife was one of those Catholics. His mother-in-law was rather wealthy, and Vermeer's own father had gone bankrupt shortly before his death, which was when Vermeer was a young man, shortly before he got married. It's hard to separate all of those things, that there was a certain economic advantage for Vermeer, and that is how he lived his life. He lived his life partly dependent on, supported by, his mother-in-law, and he must have converted. There are scholars debate whether that conversion was heartfelt or because he loved his wife and because there was a financial interest in it. And in the case of the little street that we were just mentioning, interestingly, I suggest that his wife is shown in the threshold, the servant is shown in the alley, probably his eldest daughter, Maria, playing with a playmate of hers, a little boy, on the front stoop. That would have been about the right age for when I date the painting, 1664. And there's a room on the far right that's cropped, but the window is open. And the funny thing is, when you make a map of the rooms, which you can do by looking at the interiors that are portrayed over and over again, that would have been the small room adjoining the front hall, which was likely the room that one of the rooms that his mother-in-law was in, so that she may even be kind of secreted in the painting, that she's not represented, but she's there because it's her house. And that tells you so much about Vermeer, that he was dependent, that he was living in somebody else's house, his passive nature, and that it's everywhere in his oeuvre, very subtly in The Little Street. A very obvious example that I argue in is The Allegory of Catholic Faith, a painting in the Metropolitan Museum in New York that has a very strange-looking, overweight model, and it's a very strange painting for Vermeer to have done, with lots of heavy-handed religious symbolism that doesn't really fit in with his paintings, and scholars have called it a failure and a mistake. I argue that it was commissioned by his mother-in-law, that he really couldn't say no to her because he was financially dependent on her, but that it's not accurately called a mistake in the sense that he rose to meet the challenge of her commissioning this work that was inimical to his style. She forced him to kind of parody himself, and he turned it into a parody of Catholicism and of her as his model.
And we're talking with Benjamin Binstock. He's an art historian who's come out with Vermeer's Family Secrets, Genius Discovery, and The Unknown Apprentice. And we've been talking about his mother-in-law a bit. And there's a painting, another painting, which you extensively talk about in the book, which reveals, I think, some of the family secrets, or you interpret it as such, and that is the Procuress. And you have his mother-in-law being the Procuress, is that correct?
Yes, that's actually was suggested by an earlier scholar. It's a very important painting, recognized as such by all scholars, that it's a crucial transition where he was started out as a history painter, but this was where he found himself, his mature vision, which is that he became a genre painter. He painted scenes of everyday life, and this Procuress scene is a brothel scene, but it's a scene of contemporary life. And
describe it just very briefly for us.
It's got four figures. There's a man on the left who's wearing a beret and holding it's actually a cittern, which is a mandolin-like instrument. By the neck, you can't see it, but I go into some detail about the different instruments in Vermeer's paintings. He's toasting a group across from him, which consists of an older, kind of heavy-set woman who's wearing what looks a little bit like a nun's cowl. And next to her is a man who looks like a soldier. He's got a red jacket with a stripe down the sleeve, looks like a kind of military jacket. And he's palming the breast of a beautiful young woman in yellow who's seated across from the toasting man. And an earlier scholar had suggested that it's long been recognized that that's Vermeer on the left, and that's a typical self-portrait pose, to be holding an instrument, to be toasting the viewer, to be wearing that kind of beret and the slashed jacket that he's wearing, which was a traditional 16th century Burgundian Netherlandish Germanic costume, so it's understandable that Dutch painters depicted themselves in that traditional northern garb. And an earlier scholar suggested that the woman across from him was his wife, which is strange because he's toasting someone else, feeling up his wife, so to speak, and his mother-in-law behind, which is also a very odd notion.
But doesn't it look like his wife? Because he painted her quite a bit.
Yes, she's the most common model in his scenes, and she often is depicted in yellow, which was presumably a favorite color of his and perhaps hers, and she must have also had a yellow jacket. And the funny thing is that the three figures on the right also share a certain family resemblance. They look alike, as earlier scholars have noted. I make a proposal for the unidentified fourth figure, which would have been Vermeer's brother-in-law. That was really the primal unit, the nuclear family of Vermeer's household, which was they were living in his mother-in-law's house together with his wife, and this brother, Willem, there was a third child who died in her adolescence, Cornelius, a sister. But this brother-in-law and his wife's brother, Willem, was something of a psychopath. We know from the documents that he used to torment his sister. He used to threaten to beat her when she was pregnant. And we also know from the documents that in doing so, he was repeating the behavior of his father, who used to threaten to beat his mother when she was pregnant, and also threatened to beat his daughter, Vermeer's wife. So,
an unsavory character.
A somewhat dysfunctional family as well, because his behavior seems to have been tolerated also by Vermeer. That's often been noted by commentators who've asked, didn't he do anything about this man beating his wife or threatening his brother-in-law? And one explanation would be, well, that was the family dynamic, and Vermeer wasn't in a position to challenge that he withdrew to his own studio to work. But what's fascinating about the procuress is it seems to be a sort of confession about his role in the family dynamic. It's more than a confession, though, because as this founding transitional painting in which he finds his own vision, he's really talking about the relationship of his family situation to his art. He's toasting us. He's kind of winking at us and saying, I have this dysfunctional family which I'm watching as a kind of voyeur. I'm getting a erotic pleasure. Well, several commentators before me have noted that the neck of the cittern, of the stringed instrument that he's holding, suggests a phallus, as if he was masturbating in front of what's going on, his brother-in-law assaulting his wife in a sexual way with the approval of his mother-in-law in the role of a madam in a brothel. But the gist of what he's saying, I think, is I may derive voyeuristic erotic pleasure from what's going on in my family and representing it in my paintings, but you, the viewer, do the same. I wink at you because that's what I do in painting. I represent things that you will find titillating and that you, as a voyeur, enjoy, because that's really what looking at paintings is, looking at scenes of genres, not to participate, but to look in at others.
So it's a real kind of confrontation of the viewer and an intimacy with the viewer.
Absolutely. It's a very radical statement by the young Vermeer that's in many ways also a brilliant reflection on his tradition. And there's other painters that are making voyeuristic paintings that are winking at the voyeur. There's other painters that are using their own family. But only Vermeer brought it to such a provocative point, and something that also anticipates, I would suggest, modern painters. For example, you think of Manet's Olympia, where that reclining nude is looking out at us and saying, well, you're kind of like the customer, the John. The self-consciousness of what's at stake in painting and what's at stake in the relation to the viewer. Very modern.
Well, you know, this is very interesting because one thinks of Holland in the Golden Age, in the 17th century, as being a place, I mean, after all, Dutch Protestantism is quite repressive, a place which would have very strict morals. And a lot of the paintings that, you know, we're used to seeing as rather licentious. I mean, there was Bruegel, The Elder and the Younger, and even Hieronymus Bosch. I mean, they seem fantastical creations, very extreme, really, in their expression. How do you put that together with the restrictions of Dutch society?
Simon Schama wrote a beautiful book about Dutch culture called The Embarrassment of Riches, and he tries to provide a more differentiated account of the double-sided quality, that there was a lot of moralism, but there was a lot of frank, ribald humor in the plays, and also in painters like Jan Steen. And I think that's not all that much different from America, where we have a lot of puritanism and repressive people who represent that, and there's a lot of other groups that represent a more liberating voice. And the funny thing is that you mentioned Bosch, or there's in some cases a strange connection between moralizing and a kind of display about what the moralizing is against. But to come to the gist of this, I think that a lot of interpreters, every time they see something sexual or erotic, interpret it as a moralizing lesson and a condemnation, and they're really not doing justice to the paintings. There's a great deal of pleasure for its own sake and eroticism for the sake of titillation. Paintings were bought by people to enjoy and own. It's scholars who get a little bit caught up in their own idea that they're finding moralizing messages, which I don't really think. That's not why you buy a painting or hang it on the wall in order to teach yourself something. I suppose you have the Bible or going to church for that.
But it might be a good cover for both the artist and the viewer to enjoy under the cover of this moralizing, kind of to get it past the censors.
Perhaps in some cases. In the case of the painting that we're talking about, the Procurus, interestingly, it would be very hard to suggest that there's some kind of moralizing message there, and there hasn't really ever been a reading of the painting by previous scholars. So in a way, paintings that don't fit into that narrow scheme are just left uninterpreted.
Now, you make another allegation, a real kind of bombshell of an allegation in your book, and I'm speaking with Benjamin Binstock, and the book is Vermeer's Family Secrets. You say that, in fact, some of the paintings that are now seen as Vermeer's, including the one that you have on the cover of the girl in the red hat, were in fact painted not by Vermeer, but by his daughter.
It's related to trying to provide a more careful and thorough and rigorous account of Vermeer's own oeuvre and his gradual development. One of the things that I do is I put Vermeer's paintings into chronological painting-by-painting order, and I follow his gradual development. In doing so, I argue against some datings of paintings that are wrong, but most importantly, there's a number of paintings, seven paintings, and when we're talking about 37 extant paintings, we're talking about a sixth of the paintings and a significant percentage that don't really can't be fit into any kind of coherent order.
And I'm looking right here at plate 15, and you have, as you say, paintings that are not in a progression but are actually different versions of themselves. One, you say, on the top left, Vermeer, girl with a guitar, and then one on the bottom right, which is young woman with a guitar. The two are both dressed exactly the same, in the same position. They're clearly in the same room, and yet their styles are so different. And you say one was painted by Jan Vermeer, and the other was painted by his daughter Maria Vermeer.
Yes. That's an exception, the one that you're talking about, because of I talked about seven paintings, but it's actually eight altogether. That's a painting that's now in the storage of the Philadelphia Museum. It's damaged. There's a hole in it. But it was a painting that was thought to be the treasure of the museum when it was considered a Vermeer. When the other version, that of which it's clearly a copy, in a sense, appeared, the other one was hidden away and was thought to be an 18th century copy, and there was even some technical examination seemed to prove that. But when the technical examination was redone, it turned out that that couldn't be the case. It actually has to be a copy, and a free copy made by someone at the end of Vermeer's life. So it's really a real problem. Who would be doing this with this painter who was very obscure in his time? We don't have any other comparisons like this. But when we talk about the other seven paintings, those are paintings that were clearly made using the same models, the same rooms in the house, the same objects and paintings on the wall, but by someone with a very different sensibility and different technical capacity, even different use of materials. And to try to summarize as simply as possible, everyone agrees that Vermeer is a perfectionist. Anyone who knows anything about Vermeer knows that's what's the most characteristic quality of Vermeer's paintings. And these other paintings are anything but perfectionist. They're actually very expressive and bold. They take wild risks and make mistakes.
Almost impressionistic in some ways.
They are. They were the one that you're talking about on the cover, which is in the National Gallery in Washington, the girl with the red hat, was said by some scholars to seem to anticipate the 19th century, and other scholars have actually claimed that it's a 19th century forgery that's too modern.
So why do you think that it was Maria Vermeer, Vermeer's daughter, who did these? And you also think that it's a self-portrait.
That's right. That's an important part of it. I would say first, We have these paintings that clearly don't fit in with Vermeer's development, but seem to have been done by a follower. This is someone who's pastiching, who's piecing together different works, composition, elements of compositions by Vermeer, someone who seems to be even interacting with him, because there's a kind of influence, a back-and-forth influence you can see. So it's a follower of Vermeer, and he didn't have any official students, because he would have registered official students with the guild, and there's no such record. But painters never registered their own children, understandably. You were allowed to teach your child anything you wanted. They didn't pay a fee, and they didn't have to be registered. So the only real possible explanation is that this is one of his own children. The only real plausible candidate among his own children is his eldest daughter, Maria. And the funny thing is, you know, some earlier scholars have suggested that. They just threw out a sentence, perhaps this is one of his children, but they didn't really look into it. One of the things that I do, aside from separating off these paintings and trying to see a certain development within them and to recognize the models, that's another crucial thing, is recognizing the family members, not just in Vermeer's paintings, but in these paintings, allows you to see who is painting who, and a final crucial step is recognizing, for example, the red hat as a self-portrait. And again, this is not something I'm saying for the first time. The funny thing is, earlier scholars have mistaken it for a self-portrait or associated it with self-portraits. As recently as the 2001 show at the Metropolitan Museum, the curator Walter Liedtke says it's just like a self-portrait. The stance of the figure, the way she's leaning on her arm, the drapery over her shoulder, I would add that her right hand, the painting hand, seems to be hidden behind the chair finial, which is something you often see in self-portraits. In order, the painter is painting, and he or she covers up the painting hand because that would look odd. So I say both the contradictions in earlier scholarship where they can't account for this painting, some are arguing it's a forgery, some are arguing it's Vermeer, who could have done this, a self-portrait, all of that comes together and is resolved in a simple explanation, which is this is Vermeer's eldest daughter who's working as his apprentice.
And how come there would be no record of that? Was it because she was a woman or because she was his daughter? I mean, why?
That would be a sufficient explanation in itself, which is we very rarely have records of women painters. And there's women painters that we don't know about. The ones that we do know about, it's never recorded in any way that she was studying with the father. We know about them because of other reasons, because of some kind of litigation or because they became famous enough for someone to mention them. In this case, I'm saying a further crucial piece of understanding this was she was a family secret, the most important family secret, because at the end of Vermeer's life, his debts were running up. It was life-threatening to the family, and they all knew that those debts had to be paid. I don't think she necessarily began this way. I think she was his model. I think she was his assistant, helping him perhaps grind paints and for other purposes. But she became so involved in his art as the girl with the pearl earring, a famous painting. I think that was Vermeer's eldest daughter, and she was already involved in his art, and she wanted to try out for herself. She must have been very talented. She must have been very bold. Vermeer perhaps recognized that he wouldn't live to see his son become old enough to become his apprentice. But I think that once she started doing things and was talented enough with these early self-portraits, Vermeer quickly realized that she would be able to use her paintings as his own to pay off debts, which is what they did. They, after he died, two paintings were traded against the baker to the baker against this huge debt for the family's bread, what their daily bread. And these paintings could only logically be explained as works of the daughter if she was, in fact, his secret apprentice because of financial duress, and that would also explain why we have no evidence. In a small town, they couldn't allow it to get out that she was learning from him and producing his paintings. It had to be a family secret, something that would not have been all that difficult for a family that was already hidden Catholics. They kept to themselves. They had learned to dissimulate.
And she is a wonderful painter in her own right. Benjamin Binstock, thank you so much for talking with us here about probably my favorite painter and producing this beautiful book, Vermeer's Family Secrets, Genius, Discovery, and the Unknown Apprentice.
Thank you for having me.
You can see Vermeer's The Little Street and The Procuress at writersvoice.net. You'll also see the painting Binstock says was Maria Vermeer's self-portrait, Girl in the Red Hat. The Dutch poet and composer Constantijn Huygens was a contemporary of Jan Vermeer. Here's a poem he wrote to a Catholic friend, which still has relevance today, no matter what creed we hold. It's called Friendly Disagreement. Oh, let us, my Romish friend, be wise and not begin upon those things that we so sadly differ in. But let us concentrate, agree, and cooperate, and against other misbeliefs together firmly stand. We've common ground enough to praise God hand in hand. Although we may not of two faiths a mixture make, we both at least seek heaven, though different roads we take. Genevans with Romans go like the Austrian rivers flow. For a good deal of the way of faith, our concord makes us one, as the two rivers, many miles, without mixing, run. Constantijn Huygens' poem, Friendly Disagreement, was written in 1667. Coming up, more family mysteries, this time of a fictional nature. We talk with suspense writer Hallie Efron. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Hallie Efron knows a lot about mystery writing. For years, she and psychologist Donald Davidoff co-authored the Peter Zak mystery series under the shared pseudonym G.H. Efron. She also reviews mystery novels for the Boston Globe. And she's written a how-to book, Writing and Selling Your Mystery Novel, How to Knock 'em Dead with Style. So it's no surprise that Efron's finally come out with a mystery novel that's all her own. Never Tell a Lie isn't so much a whodunit as a how did they do it and why. It's about a young pregnant couple whose domestic bliss is disturbed when a woman from their past shows up at their yard sale. She goes inside their house and never comes out. The novel poses the question, how well do we know the people we love? And how far are we willing to go to protect our secrets? Well, Hallie Efron, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
Never Tell a Lie. I found it absolutely gripping. I loved it.
Good.
It's both a mystery tale and a horror story in a way.
Well, interesting that you should say that. I would say it has gothic elements. I don't know that I would say it has horror, because actually I was pretty careful not to go that far.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think gothic is actually the perfect word. But describe that for us. You know, this is not a mere mystery. Talk about incorporating those gothic elements, and why did you?
The mystery in the novel is that a couple has a yard sale, and somebody shows up at the yard sale whom they haven't seen for a long time. A young woman that they knew from high school. She goes, she talks her way into the house. David takes her inside and shows her the inside. And she never comes out of the house. She just disappears inside it. So immediately you're thinking, well, what did the house swallow her up? Is there someone else in the house who took her? When I got the idea, I started to think down all those pathways. And that whole idea of a house, you know, with a personality.
A Victorian house.
A Victorian house is certainly one that's been worked over by the great Gothic writers. So that was, you know, the starting point, the house and a disappearance and what happened to her. And, you know, then strange things start to happen. And, you know, it feels a little like ghosts or a presence or a spirit or something. And it's more of a what's going on here than a whodunit.
Yes, you think in terms of spirits, but in fact, it's not spirits, it's psychology, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You know, I would never write a book about spirits. So that's part of the problem when you read my work, as you know, I'm very firmly grounded in the here and now. You're not going to find a lot of woo-woo in my books, but I love using the possibility of something extraterrestrial or ghosts to spice up the suspense, even though in the end, of course, it turns out to be the real world with real messy kinds of explanations, as there always are in the real world.
Yeah, and now, of course, with a mystery, we don't want to give too much away. But, as you say, this started at a yard sale. In fact, you got the idea when you went to a yard sale.
I did. I went to a yard sale around the corner from where I live, and it was this big Victorian that my daughter used to play in when she was little. Not a good Victorian, but one of these, you know, sort of a mass of little rooms connected to each other. And I'd seen all the decorator vans and builders in and out of the house. I knew they'd done major reconstruction, so I asked the woman all kinds of questions about the inside. You know, had she kept the tin ceiling in the kitchen? And on I'm asking. And finally, I think she was just trying to shut me up. She says, "Would you like to go inside and look around?" And I grabbed the opportunity, checked to be sure she meant it, let myself in, and I was all alone in this beautifully renovated house. They'd torn out walls. It was just spectacular. And I'm wandering through the first floor, wander up to the second floor, and it was on the way to my the third floor that the idea struck me that maybe a woman talks her way into the house, goes inside, and doesn't come out. And I was down those stairs and out into that driveway so fast. It really spooked me.
Now, the woman you're talking about, her name is Melinda.
Melinda disappears, yeah.
All right. And she's in the house of Ivy and David Rose. Ivy is pregnant. And Melinda, well, the idea is that she's also pregnant.
She's also pregnant, yes.
Talk about her character. They all knew each other in high school.
Yeah, they knew each other, but not especially well because, you know, high school is one of those kind of, it's like a layer cake, you know, different people are in different strata of it. And so David, Ivy's husband, was kind of, you know, the Adonis, the football jock, the one everybody wanted to hang out with, but basically a nice kid, not a bully. And Ivy was that kind of middle tier kid, kind of nerdy. She was an athlete, but not the best. She was a writer, but not the best. She was politically active, but not a leader. So, you know, she's just that kind of middle-of-the-road kid who makes it through high school watching everyone else, kind of like I did. And then there's Melinda, and Melinda was the kid who sat alone at a lunch table. The kid who kids would say, "Ooh, she smells," even when she didn't. The kid whose mother walked her to school and who was always, you know, just a little inappropriate socially, didn't really know how to make friends, and was, you know, mercilessly teased and victimized, really, by the other kids. Now, a lot of people have that experience in high school, and a lot of us, you know, grow up just so happy that high school's behind us. We find our friends in college. We find our center. And then there are people who grow up damaged by that experience, and Melinda's one of those people.
Say a little bit more about that damage. Did you know somebody like that, or how did you imagine yourself into her mind?
I think we all know people like that. I mean, I've had friends who've had a child who was in that situation. It's heartbreaking from the inside because that's a kid who, you know, really doesn't know what to do to make the teasing and so on go away. And fortunately, thank God, my kids have never been in that position. I've never been in that position, but certainly all through high school, I know there were kids like that. And, you know, they would come and try to be friends, and I felt the guilt of, you know, pushing them away, a particular girl in my high school who I didn't want to be her friend. I didn't want to be thought about as her friend. And it's a horrible thing to think back on, you know, to have that kind of complicity in the group torture of an individual. You know, we all have a little bit of that in our past.
Unless we're on the other side of it.
Unless we're on the other side of it, that's exactly right. And then it just seems incomprehensible that people could treat you that way. And I think for a lot of people, a rage can build and a need for some kind of comeuppance, some kind of revenge.
Exactly. Mm. We won't go too much into
that
revenge.
No, I was going to say, don't go too far down that road.
But it does figure in the book.
Yep.
And also distrust figures at the very center of the book.
That's right.
Talk about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the title of the book, Never Tell a Lie, was not the title that I wanted. But it turns out to be a really good title for the book. The title I wanted was Baby Baby, which is the two pregnant women with the two babies. But the publisher felt that sounded too much like a how-to manual for young mothers. They wanted it to be a little more suspenseful. So Never Tell a Lie was born, and I think it's a great title because it's a book about secrets and lies, really. It's a book about the little lies we tell to varnish over secrets, you know, so early in the book, and I'm not going to give too much away by this, but, you know, David tells Ivy that he saw Melinda leave the house. Well, it's going to turn out that's not quite true. But why does he lie like that? Why doesn't he just tell the truth? Well, there's something deeper there. And so it's a process of excavating over time. And for Ivy, it's excruciating because here's the man she loves. She's adored him ever since she first thought it might be possible that he might like her. And she's completely dependent on him now. I mean, she's on leave from work. She's all alone at home. And now she's discovering that he's been lying to her. So it really shakes her at a point in her life where she's as vulnerable as she could possibly be.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking to Hallie Efron about her mystery novel, Never Tell a Lie. Efron is a sister of writer Nora Efron. Okay, so here we have a young woman who's in a very vulnerable position. Her husband hasn't been quite truthful with her. He loves her. Do you think he's thinking that he's actually protecting her?
I don't know that he's thinking that clearly. I think he might say that he's protecting her. I think he's protecting both of them from something that he thinks of something way in the past that he doesn't think, you know, bears much relevance to what's going on in the present, even though it is. So I think he's trying to protect himself. I think he's trying to protect her. And I think he just gets deeper and deeper in and can't figure out how to get himself out.
And she discovers unknown sources of strength within herself.
She does, physical and emotional. Yeah. I think, you know, Ivy is really thrown back on her own resources. She's all of a sudden completely alone. I mean, she has a friend or two, and she's got a neighbor. But more and more, she starts feeling like the house is getting bigger around her. As she grows smaller within it, that sense of being alone and thrown back on your own resources, I think she starts to realize she can't trust David, and so she starts to investigate her on her own.
Hmm. Do you think it's important for people in relationships to never tell a lie?
No, I don't. I absolutely don't. I think we tell lies all the time. I think there are little lies and big lies. I think sometimes the truth is needlessly hurtful. And I think that's probably part of the trap that David falls into, is he doesn't see any reason to hurt his wife, to destroy an image of him that she has, to shake her faith in him by telling her something. And that leads to negative consequences, but it doesn't always. I mean, we lie all the time to the people that we love.
You know, I also thought of the book in maybe a larger sense, almost. It's almost a metaphor. You know, here you have this, you know, well-off young couple. I mean, they're not, you know, rich maybe, but they're comfortable.
Yep.
And they're young, and they've got this Victorian, which they're fixing up, and they have their own business, and, you know, everything. It's just kind of the perfect life.
Yes.
And then you have this woman who has, you know, fought and scrabbled for every little piece that she's been able to get for herself. That's Melinda. Was there some of that, too, kind of the outsider looking in a class sense as well?
I hadn't really thought about that, Francesca. Now that you mention it, though, I don't think there's a class element to it. They all grew up basically in the same neighborhood. I mean, Melinda had a very protective mother. Ivy has a mother who was an alcoholic, mm-hmm. and she and her mother lived with her grandmother. David lived the sheltered life. David had wealthy parents. So if anything, the class difference would be between David on the one hand and Ivy and Melinda. I wasn't thinking about class when I wrote them.
Right, and that makes sense to me. But it's something like that. You know, there's a sense of the golden, you know, the golden couple.
Yep.
And then the people who are on the outs.
Yeah, and I think that's what happens here is they get knocked off their pedestal by someone who's on the outside. And it's kind of, you know, a fantasy to be able to show these people for who they really are, except if you are those people, you know, you don't want to be, you know, you feel really shaken when that happens to you. But I'm glad that you're saying that because I was hoping people would find Melinda sympathetic.
Right. I mean, not for a long part of the book is she particularly sympathetic, but that was the another thing I was going to ask you. I mean, did you develop compassion for her, or do you allow the compassion to develop through your writing for the reader, but you had it from the beginning?
I always felt compassionate toward Melinda, and one of the things that was especially difficult for me was writing the ending of that book, because I wanted it to be a little messy the way real life is. When bad things happen in real life and a number of people are involved in them, everyone sees it differently. Different people will ascribe blame to different individuals involved in the situation. They'll feel so-and-so could have stopped something from happening. Someone else could have changed the course of events. And I wanted to kind of give that, it's, you know, a little like, here's a great cliche, the Rashomon kind of thing, where you have an event and you have all these different perspectives on who did what to whom, whose fault was it. And I wanted that in the book. I wanted that messy reality. I didn't want a nicely tied up, you know, ending in which, you know, the bad guy, you know, goes to jail and the good people are vindicated. Because I don't think in real life there is that clear delineation between good and bad. I think people who hurt other people are doing it because they think they need to, they have to, they are righting some prior wrong, and so on. So I wanted to get that kind of insider's perspective of my characters.
Hmm. We're talking with Hallie Efron about her mystery novel, Never Tell a Lie. Now, you review mystery novels for the Boston Globe. You've written a book about writing mystery novels. I've often thought that if you want to write a mystery novel, you have to have the ending, you have to know the ending before you start, that it's all kind of laid out in a very careful way. But you said before that, you know, the ending was difficult for you. Talk about your process of writing this mystery novel. Was it like the normal way that people write mystery novels, or is there such a thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, there isn't such a thing. If you talk to 10 mystery writers, they'll each give you 10 different ways of writing, honestly. So many different ways. There's the planners and the not planners. You know, the people who say, oh, I can't outline because then I'll know what I'm writing and I won't be surprised, so the writing won't be fresh. And then other people who say, oh, I can't write without outlining because I don't know what'll happen. There's all kinds of different ways of writing. But for me, with this book, I started with that idea. What if a woman goes to yard sale, she goes in the house, and she never comes out? And I knew my characters. I knew that Ivy would be the wife, that she'd be the protagonist, that she would be pregnant, that the woman coming would be pregnant. I had a little bit of an idea of who David would be. And I knew the house. The house is a house that my husband and I once bid on many decades ago and fortunately didn't get because we were very undermatched for what that house needed. We had a pitiful income and even more pitiful home repair skills, so it was very fortunate that we didn't get the house. But those were the elements that I started with. And I really just started writing. I would kind of push the outline ahead of me as I saw what was going to happen. I'd add a little more to the outline. And as I saw what I'd written, and of course I didn't write according to the outline, I would fix it. As a result, and I don't recommend this process because it's very ugly, I ended up getting stuck quite a few times. And I just didn't know how to move the story forward. Or I knew what needed to happen next, but I just couldn't make the characters go there. So, for instance, at one point, one of the characters gets locked in an attic. And honestly, for 6 weeks, I was stuck in that attic with that character, trying to figure out how the heck I was going to get that person out of the attic. And it wasn't until I was driving to Connecticut, and I tell you, breakthroughs in plot seem to always come when I can't write, like in the shower, frying chicken, in the bathtub, on the phone, wherever I haven't got a pencil, driving. So I'm driving along, and I'm thinking about children's games. And I'm thinking about Monopoly with all those wonderful little metal pieces and the beautifully vibrant Candyland cards. And then my mind switched over to Chutes and Ladders. Remember Chutes and Ladders?
Mm-hmm, I sure did.
Well, I won't tell you if it's a chute or, well, you know if it's a chute or a ladder that got that character out of the attic. But I was out of the attic at that moment. And by the time I got home, I had it all figured out. In 10 minutes, I could write the pages that had eluded me for 6 weeks, and I was on my way to the next plot hole.
Well, you know, that's a marvelous description, I think, of the creative process,
mm-hmm.
of how things happen when you take your mind off, when you get out of the frame that you've been stuck in.
That's right. When you stop trying to force it, often the inspiration will come. But I think it's that forcing and thinking and working at it, I think that does pay off. I just think there's not a direct connection. I don't think you see it, but I think all that work that you do before does contribute to that aha moment.
It's like you have to spade the earth, but then let the little seedling grow.
Yeah, or bang the jar on the ground a couple of times before you try trying to open the lid.
Now, you in your book about writing mystery novels, what are some of the rules that, whether you follow them or not in this one, what are some of the rules that you suggest to people in taking up that kind of genre?
Well, there's two big rules that I think I really did follow in this. One is there's no place for coincidence in a book that is a mystery. You cannot have major things happen in the book because of coincidence. And so that's, you just can't have two characters happen to run into each other or happen to find a piece of evidence nothing can be coincidental. It all has to be engineered. Now, the real life is full of coincidences. I'm not saying that's unrealistic. I'm just saying mystery readers are very intolerant of coincidence. They want things not to be coincidental. And the second thing is...
Well, and let me ask you, mm-hmm. why is that?
Because it feels like what the old detective club, the very first detective club of writers, would have called jiggery pokery. It feels like the writer didn't do enough work to come up with a really credible plot. It isn't believable.
Right.
And the second thing in writing that I'm always telling people to do, and it's in the book, is that you might have heard mystery how-to talk about clues and red herrings, and the investigator finds all these clues that lead to the true killer and the red herrings that lead them in the wrong direction. But I think the real, I don't think those really are the important elements in making a mystery novel work. I think it's secrets.
Secrets?
Secrets, yes. Secrets that some characters know and some characters don't know. Secrets and actually misconceptions. And when people behave as if they know something that isn't true, you can run the plot in one direction. Some people know a secret and some people don't. You know, it all provides grist for those big moments when you can reveal a secret and all of a sudden a character's behavior that looked suspicious all of a sudden is explained. So the revelation of secrets, and of course that's the major thing underlying this novel, is secrets from the past.
And hence also the name, Never Tell a Lie.
Never Tell a Lie, yep. Yep.
Now, your siblings are also writers. Nora Ephron is very well known. And then you also have Delia and Amy.
That's right.
Are screenwriters. Why did you go down the mystery road?
Well, I would say in part because they didn't. You know, it's hard enough writing knowing that you're going to be compared to a huge talent. I mean, a colossal talent like Nora Ephron. So, you know, it's a little easier to go down the road not taken by her and write a mystery. I also think I love mysteries. I love the puzzle. I love figuring it out like an inch before the main character figures it out. I like the game element of it. I like the suspense. I like the page-turningness. They're fun. I wanted to write a book that was fun to read, fun to write. And I can't write romantic suspense, I can't write romantic comedy, which is what my sisters Nora and Delia are so great at. I'm just not that funny or that romantic, I guess. My strong suit is in mystery writing. And as I say, I was a big Nancy Drew fan as a kid and cut my teeth on P.D. James and Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and have continued reading mysteries and really loving them. And it's a less demanding genre than literary fiction, which has kind of loosey-goosey standards. You know, you can get away with all kinds of things in literary fiction, whereas mystery fiction has, you know, genre standards. It's got certain things that readers expect. When they pull a book off a shelf that said mystery at Barnes & Noble, they expect certain things in it. And for me, as a writer who was not an English major, I don't have a master's in fine arts in writing. I don't have that pedigree. I think writing mysteries was a way of, you know, getting into something where there were rules, there were genre boundaries, and there were kind of constraints that I could make work for myself.
Well, you certainly did make it work for me, too, as a reader. We've been talking with Hallie Efron. Her debut novel as a solo mystery writer is Never Tell a Lie. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you very, very much.
Hallie Efron reviews mysteries for the Boston Globe, and as G.H. Efron, she collaborated with neuropsychologist Donald Davidoff on the Peter Zak mystery series. Hallie Efron also blogs at Jungle Red, an online salon by six women mystery writers. You can find a link at writersvoice.net. Next week, we're moving to a new schedule. Look for us on Mondays at 4:30, starting January 26. We'll be re-airing this show, so if you missed a part of it or want to hear it again, tune in at 4:30 right here on WMUA on Monday, January 26. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.